The Oswald cartoons are not just examples of early Disney animation, but are part of the development of American art forms, animation, and the evolution of cinema. Both are important disciplines that have contributed to individual cultures around the world and have impacted society, writes author David A. Bossert, animation historian and, lucky for us, Oswald the Lucky Rabbit expert. Hello everyone and welcome back to the Anthropomorphic Theater of the Golden Silent Films podcast. With some historical cartoons queued up and the lowdown about one of the world's biggest furry conventions ready to be dished out, we have a jam-packed episode in store for all of you fine listeners, both furry and non-furry. Before we enjoy some charismatic critters on the silver screen, let's give the usual Golden Silent Films podcast social media roundup. As usual, please join Golden Silence Cast on Instagram for up-to-date info on this little show. And for all of you furry folks on Twitter, just follow at GoldenSilence1 or just search for Golden Silence Cast and we should pop up for you. All those screen names and sites will be in the episode description in case you are interested in checking us out. We would love to have you on board, and at both social spaces you'll get behind-the-scenes pics and info, upcoming episode reveals, and other fun film-related materials. And don't forget, great photos of our regularly pomorphic cats. Also, if you're enjoying this program on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, do leave a review, a rating, or if you're feeling frisky, both. All of those ratings and reviews help this program greatly. Live your best review-leaving life and help our show grow and reach fellow silent film fans. Whether getting us more exposure in the wonderfully animated podcast land or letting us know how we can improve, we appreciate that feedback and always want to bring you the best show possible. And do us a favor and subscribe to the Golden Silent Films podcast. While our output can be seemingly haphazard, if you are subscribed, you will be a lucky rabbit and never miss an episode. And the moment new content drops, it will go straight to your listening device of choice. We are paw deep in our third season and don't want you to miss a second. So, on a basic surface level, we put this episode together to take a deeper look into the earliest days of Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. Going a bit deeper, though, we are taking a look at one of the earliest anthropomorphic animated characters to take the world by storm. This episode is about Oswald for sure, but it is also a look at the anthro characters and their associations with the furry fandom. This program is, was, and always will be unapologetically Pittsburgh. We here at the Golden Silent Films podcast are incredibly proud of our little section of the world and are always trying to fit some Berg-based backstory and lore into as many episodes as possible. This episode will be no different. In fact, it is because of Pittsburgh that this episode has taken the shape it has. Now, a ton of really cool, really fun things happen in Pittsburgh every year. But one of the biggest, financially and attendance-wise, is AnthroCon. This is one of the biggest furry conventions in the world, and a necessary pilgrimage for many folks in the furry fandom. This four-day-long party and social gathering happens at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center in downtown Pittsburgh. The festivities take place all through downtown and overlook and go out on the Allegheny River. When AnthroCon is in full swing, the events are seemingly endless, running from early in the morning to late at night. It is a weekend of parties, both on sea and land. There are furry boat cruises and block parties. You can attend the world-famous Fursuit Parade, see furry art shows, or enjoy and learn from any one of the many workshops and panels covering topics like animation, puppet making, video games, writing, and even panels with fur science, and so much more. Before we go too far down the rabbit hole, let's talk about furries for any of our fine listeners who aren't familiar with the term or the fandom as a whole. Any dive into the subject of furries has to start with the great organization Fur Science, which you can find online at furscience.com or catch them on Facebook and Twitter by typing in at furscience, F-U-R-S-C-I-E-N-C-E, at furscience. The term furry, according to Fur Science, describes a diverse community of fans, artists, writers, gamers, and role players. Most furries create for themselves an anthropomorphized animal character or fursona with whom they identify and can function as an avatar within the community. Some furries wear elaborate costumes called fursuits or paraphernalia such as animal ears or tails. Fur Science continues, The furry fandom is an inclusive term that describes the community of furries that span online, local, and international settings. The furry fandom is global, with hundreds of local groups existing worldwide and dozens of conventions held annually. If you're unfamiliar, Furry Science is an interdisciplinary team of social scientists who've been studying the furry fandom for over a decade. Their goal has been to conduct studies on the furry fandom, bringing in questions from scientists, furries, and laypersons alike, and make that data available in scientific outlets and journals and on their website. There on the website, furries, laypeople, and the media alike can access those results. A secondary goal based on this work is to help dispel misconceptions that exist about the furry fandom by shining the light of empirical inquiry onto them and by giving the fandom the data it needs to push back against harmful misconceptions that arise in a vacuum. While we're on the topic of fur science, it is with great pleasure that we introduce a special guest that will be joining us throughout the episode. We had a great deep-diving chat about the furry fandom with Dr. Courtney Plant, co-founder of Fur Science. We talked about all things furry fandom, anthro cartoon characters, and the magic of AnthroCon here in Pittsburgh. Dr. Plant is the perfect person to go to for any furry inquiries. He has his hands in virtually all aspects of the research side of things. In recounting what he does within the organization, he explains, "In addition to helping design studies and write papers and books, I'm the lead data analyst for the team, doing most of the statistics and handling most of the data entry and archiving. If you were to meet him at a convention, however, you would see him hard at work in his fursona of Nuka. Initially, he was and still is the only furry on the Fur Science team, which sparked his initial interest in studying the furry fandom back at the start. As a furry, Nuka is able to attend a lot of conventions, but is often in the service of those scientific interests. Because I frequently attend a half dozen or so furry conventions a year, I'm also frequently the face of the team, giving research panels at various conventions where I help disseminate our research to the fandom and keeps folks up to date with our research," Nuka tells me. Now, earlier I had made a comment about the connection between animated anthropomorphic characters and the furry fandom. The two things really go together like peanut butter and jelly. As you walk through AnthroCon, or really any furry convention for that matter, you're going to see the influence of animation everywhere around you. One of the coolest things about the furry fandom is its creativity. While you can see those influences, furries take that inspiration and create their own unique fursonas. Even though anthro animation brings many people to the fandom, there really is no set official character, genre, or intellectual property to constrain it. Furries really do create their own universes. Now, with all that being said, it is so perfect that we are introducing you fine listeners to the furry fandom through a creation of Walt Disney and UB Iwerks. This synergy is best articulated by Dr. Plant, a.k.a. Nuka, a.k.a. Dr. Nuka, when he tells me about the cartoons that bring folks into the fandom. Nuka, with hard numbers from Fur Science Research, explains, "We've actually got data on this indirectly, not about specific characters per se, but about which shows, series were the most influential on a furry becoming a furry. This is where the connecting point comes in and we tie this episode all together." Nuka continues, "The single biggest contributor media-wise is film and television, and the biggest of those is, to no one's great surprise, Disney. Robin Hood, Lion King, Zootopia, even in samples around the world, e.g. Southeast Asia, North America, Europe, we can see these films as being amongst the most influential in contributing to furries becoming furries." While Nuka talks up television and film as leading the charge, he is quick to add that there are quite a few other on-ramps to the furry fandom. According to Nuka, the next biggest influence is video games, with Sonic the Hedgehog being the king of furry creators. Next, you have book series like Animorphs and classics like Watership Down and Redwall. Below that are comic books and webcomics, perhaps being eclipsed a little bit in popularity by fursuiting, social media, and YouTube and the fandom as a focus. Not only do these pieces of media serve as an influence to enter the fandom, but they can also be a representation of anthro characters who, like Hansel, are so hot right now. Dr. Nuka explains, "Certain species will come into and out of the fandom spotlight whenever a character of that species features prominently in a piece of popular media. Of course, many species are staples of the fandom owing to their prevalence in pop culture. but you can notice the trend most strongly in species that are just on the fringe of popularity and watching them pop into center stage in the wake of a new show. So, you've learned a bit about the furry fandom. Let's turn our attention to the lucky rabbit at the center of this little anthropomorphic adventure. Now, the first major reference material behind this episode comes in the form of an amazing set of DVDs released by Disney. I am talking about the Walt Disney Treasures, The Adventures of Oswald the Lucky Rabbit set, released on December 11th, 2007. This is an incredible collection that really pays tribute to the character and everyone behind his creation, with a special emphasis on the legendary animator Ub Iwerks. This set includes the 13 Oswald shorts that were available at the time of release, as well as a selection of Alice comedies and the earliest Mickey shorts. What makes this episode list even cooler is that a handful of the episodes contain audio commentaries. Also, on the sound front, silent film composer Robert Israel has composed some great new scores for these shorts. They are phenomenal and really add to the experience. There is also a wonderful feature-length documentary entitled The Hand Behind the Mouse, telling the story of Ub Iwerks that was made by his granddaughter Leslie. It is great to see a focus on someone whose name often gets forgotten or lost behind the mega name of Walt Disney. In addition to all of that great stuff, you get some great insights from film historian and generally great movie mind of Leonard Maltin. As I was researching this episode, it really, actually proved tough to find good sources and info on Ub Iwerks. The work of Walt Disney definitely carries a lot of the spotlight, and finding strictly Ub-centric accounts stymied me a handful of times. That's why I love this documentary. It was fantastic to really get to hear the story of Ub Iwerks from those who knew him and loved him the most. He was really a film pioneer. Not just an animation pioneer, but a film pioneer. I hope more people can see this documentary and really have their minds blown. Such great, amazing stuff, and a lot of great archival footage. This is really a masterwork of a DVD collection, and a great example of why physical media is so important. These are available on YouTube, the shorts, but at lesser qualities. And you would think Disney Plus would have all this great stuff and this great content, but you would be wrong. If you can snag this collection, do it, and you will thank me later. In addition to that amazing DVD set is an equally amazing book by David A. Bossert. This book is entitled Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, The Search for the Lost Disney Cartoons. This book is an impressive and important piece of the mythos and history of Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. You get incredible looks into the early years of the Disney and Iwerks collaboration, as well as the wild history of Oswald. It is incredibly in-depth, giving looks into actual telegrams and correspondence that is nearly 100 years old. I really felt part of the creative process and that I was watching the story play out in front of me. These letters and telegrams really tell a wild story. A lot of ups and downs, a lot of betrayals, a lot of successes, failures, heartbreak. It really is an amazing story, and it was a great, great read that really helped you feel more immersed in the backstory of this cartoon character. You also get a detailed breakdown of every Oswald short produced under the Disney banner. There are synopses and behind-the-scenes information on each one, including shorts that have long since been lost. While on the topic of lost Oswald shorts, the version I read was a revised special edition which included great information on the incredible discoveries of Oswald shorts since the original book was published. This cartoon series was certainly lucky, and the tales in this book recount, and these book accounts really make that apparent. I can't recommend this book enough. David A. Bossert has gone above and beyond in his contribution to cinema preservation and animation history. Our trip down biography lane, though, this episode will introduce us to two legendary animators and one lucky rabbit. All roads will lead to a historic cartoon series that lived a wild and adventurous life in its own right. The legendary name of Walt Disney started with little Walter Elias Disney being born on December 5th, 1901 in Chicago, Illinois. The future animator was one of five children birthed to parents Elias and Flora. In 1906, the Disney clan would relocate to Marceline, Missouri. This is roughly when and where 4-year-old Walt would begin to develop his interests in art and drawing. but his entry into art came from a dark place, though. In an article about the life of Walt Disney in Entrepreneur magazine, we learn, Walt Disney's childhood was anything but idyllic. His father was a strict disciplinarian who thought nothing of taking a switch to Walt and his brother Roy to administer corrective beatings that became part of their daily routine. Young Walt found an escape from his father's brutality through drawing. By 1911, the Disney family was firmly entrenched in Kansas City, Missouri. During his time at Benton Grammar School, young Walt was introduced to the world of theater, vaudeville, and motion pictures. Walt and his brother Roy worked hard on a paper route delivering the Kansas City Star and the Kansas City Times on behalf of their father Elias, who would work the boys hard only to keep all the money they made for himself. With early morning deliveries at 4:30 a.m., in addition to an evening edition delivery after school, stellar grades on the old report card were not in the cards for Walt. Despite that grueling schedule of work and school, Walt was never too tired to engage in a bit of drawing here and there. In an article for the Archbridge Institute website, we learn about Walt's devotion to art. The article, entitled Walt Disney, Entrepreneur Without Peer, and written by Gary Hoover, reads, And Walt kept drawing. When a teacher assigned students to sketch the flowers on her desk, Walt got in trouble for putting faces on the flowers and arms where the leaves should be. He earned free haircuts by doing characters of the customers at the local barber shop. When he was 14, Walt enrolled in classes at the Kansas City Art Institute. He read every book about drawing and cartooning that he could get his hands on. He might not have been a great student in regular school, but he loved to learn about the things that interested him. He would push on, however, continuing this heavy workload, even squeezing in those Saturday courses at the Kansas City Art Institute and a correspondence course in cartooning. The Disney family was back on the move in 1917, this time returning to Chicago. On the educational side of the ledger, Walt was now free to draw, unfettered by the relentless grind of newspaper delivery. He enrolled at McKinley High School, where he joined the school newspaper as a cartoonist. At the same time, Walt was taking night classes at the Chicago Academy of Fine Arts. With the onset of World War I, Walt answered the call of service in 1918, only to be turned away on account of his being underage. Not one to give up easily, Disney took a little artistic license with his birth certificate and made it more numerically acceptable to the authorities. With those changes, he joined the Red Cross in September of 1918. He arrived in France, but after the armistice that brought the terrible war to a close. While there, he used his artistic powers to decorate the sides of ambulances with cartoons. Kansas City would be his landing spot upon returning to the States in October of 1919. While in KC, Walt picked up work as an apprentice artist at the Pessman Rubin Commercial Art Institute. While employed there, the young artist drew illustrations for ads, theater programs, and catalogs. More importantly than that, however, would be the meeting and team-up of Walt Disney and fellow artist Ub Iwerks. Now, we're going to take a quick break from the Walt Disney side of the story and swing our attention over to the aforementioned Ub Iwerks. While Walt Disney has the big spotlight and the ubiquitous name, Ub Iwerks is the lesser-known side of this partnership that laid the groundwork for the future of animation. Ubba Ert Iwerks was born on March 24, 1901 in Kansas City, Missouri. His father was from abroad, having moved to the United States in 1869 at the age of 14. There is a bit of confusion surrounding the family tree of Ub. You'll see in a lot of places that he is of Dutch descent, but his father was actually a German immigrant, according to an in-depth Ub Iwerks biography on the Lambeck Comiclopedia website at lambeck.net, we get more clarification. The article reads, Even the 1940 U.S. federal census lists that both of Ub's parents came from the Netherlands, but in fact, his father's family was Prussian, while his mother's family came from Indiana. Ert Ubba Iwerks was 57 at the time of young Ub's birth, while his mother, Laura May Wagner, was 26. His father was an amateur inventor with a keen interest in sound and film and recording devices. In fact, it was his father's love of film that may have had a big impact on the youngster. Like many bits of information from this era, who the heck really knows what the truth is? Was he German? Was he from the Netherlands? The truth is out there, but who knows what it really is, but that was the best I could find, was that they were of Prussian descent. It's all part of the charm, I guess, of researching this stuff. Records aren't the most reliable things, you'll see. Ub attended Ashland Grammar School and graduated in 1914. Schooling, though, would not be in the future for the young man, however. You see, Ub's father is not really someone that would ever be considered for any Dad of the Year awards. His father had a history of loving and leaving previous wives and children, and it would be no different with Ub and his mom. As a result of his father's abandonment, the young Iwerks dropped out of school to help support his mother. He would never speak of his father again. By 1919, Ub Iwerks was gainfully employed at the Pessman Rubin Art Studio in Kansas City. Actually, he was hired 1 month prior to Walt's arrival. And that is where we left off earlier and where we will pick up our biographical conversation, this time with a focus on the new drawing duo. The two were able to strike up a friendship in short order. They would bond over troubled childhoods and a love for art. Their love of drawing really brought out the best in each other. As 1920 started, the revenues of the Pessman Rubin studio began to dwindle. This turn in company fortunes caused Walt and Ub to be laid off. Shortly after, the two decided to go into business for themselves. This new startup was called Iwerks Disney Commercial Artists. The venture did not last long, and the two artists found themselves seeking employment once again. We turn to the Historic Missourian's website to find out more about the next chapter in these two fellows' artistic adventures. The website, which you can find at historicmissourians.shsmo.org, writes, "From there, the two got jobs with the Kansas City Slide Company, later renamed the Kansas City Film Ad Company, making one-minute advertisements to appear before movies and live-action films. Disney learned about animation at this job and eventually felt confident enough to start his own business. It was there at the Kansas City Film Ad Company where artists Hugh Harmon, Fred Harmon, and Friz Freleng were amongst their colleagues. Those names will come into play a little later. Now, speaking of that artistic and animation inspiration, it seemed to work a bit in reverse here. You see, that company tended to use cutout animation techniques in the work they produced. The job definitely fed into Disney's fascination with animation, though he learned he preferred the aesthetic of the hand-drawn cartoons of the day. Disney's interest in cell animation led him to venturing out with a fella named Fred Harmon, a co-worker from the film ad company. According to the documentary about Ub Iwerks, we learn, "Intrigued by the possibilities of animation, Walt convinced his boss to lend him a company camera so he and Ub could create a short comedy advertisement for the local Newman Theater. Soon, he was commissioned for a series called Newman Laughograms, Cartoon Fairy Tales for the Jazz Age." Walt and his friends and former co-workers would join in on this venture, but the biggest addition was the draftsmanship on display from Ub. And speaking about the swinging style of Ub Iwerks, animation historian Russell Merritt explains, "I think it's an apt phrase because his syncopation, his extraordinary gifts for extending rhythmic lines, is what distinguishes animation from predecessors and makes him valuable to Disney." He left the film ad company in May of 1922 to start Laughogram Films in the McConaughey Building at 31st Street and Forest Avenue. Disney put out an ad in the newspaper requesting artists who wanted to learn animation to come work for him, the Historic Missourian's website writes. Now, Iwerks wasn't far behind when he joined his friend as chief animator on the Laughogram shorts starting in 1922. Despite their best efforts, longevity was not in the cards for this company either. But while they were in business, the creation of Disney's first popular and well-received film happened here in Kansas City. The film was called Alice's Wonderland and featured a real girl, played by Virginia Davis, who entered an animated world. This was the first in what would become a series commonly referred to as the Alice Comedies. Walt, Ub, and their staff made the first Alice comedy in 1923. This production was a one-reel short titled Alice's Wonderland. This film was released under the banner of the Laughogram Studio in Kansas City, Missouri. Alice's Wonderland, as a concept, would see a real girl, played by Virginia Davis, find herself in the animated world. The short begins with Alice entering a cartoon studio where she sees an animator in action. To add to her amazement, the cartoons being drawn come to life and move and play around the studio. After going to bed at night, the sleeping girl dreams that she is in a cartoon world, welcomed by all of her new animated friends. Alice plays with them until a group of lions break out of their cage and chase her. Though never officially released, this short would be a great advertisement for what this team can do and set up the concept of a real girl in a cartoon world narrative as their unique spin on the genre. The design and voice of the later productions were all set by this initial film. The UB iWorks documentary relates this. The technique UB and Walt created for the Alice comedies was very much born out of experimentation and improvisation. But it was UB's growing ability to see things through technical means that made this cartoon their best effort yet. Like I mentioned a second ago, this new animation company wasn't long for this world. And the Historic Missourian's website explains, Disney operated this new company for a year and a half. He had good ideas, but he was not a good businessman. Eventually, his staff left because they were not getting paid. Disney declared bankruptcy and left Kansas City in July of 1923 to try his luck in Hollywood. At the same time, UB was handling the dissolution of the company by returning to the film ad company. He was desperate for steady employment and to recoup the money he had invested in Laugh-O-Grams. I really have to say, after watching a fair amount of Alice comedies, I really liked them. While on the surface, they are very happy and fun, I especially enjoyed the darker bits. They were really imaginative and had a creative point of view that I've never really seen before. And I will always appreciate the weird body horror moments in the cartoons. UB really had a way of crafting something special and memorable. I also really love the violence of the shorts. It may sound weird, but the violence and sometimes deaths in these cartoons were always creative, inventive, and unique. And all of them led to laughs and really making me happy, really. For all you animation and general film fans out there, do track these down and do give them a watch. You will enjoy them, I promise. Now, in Search of Greener Pastures, the 21-year-old Walt made his way to Hollywood not long after, in July of 1923. At that time, New York was seen as the epicenter of the animation industry, but Walt made his mind up to go to California, where his brother Roy, then recuperating from tuberculosis, was located. In addition to familial bonds and connections, the young animator saw a potential future as a film director. Like I said a second ago, New York was the heart of the American animation scene. According to David Bossert, one, the Pat Sullivan Studio produced Felix the Cat, which was one of the most popular characters in theaters. Dave and Max Fleischer, recently having departed from Bray Studios, were based in New York as well, producing the Out of the Inkwell series starring Coco the Clown, the character who escapes from the Inkwell and goes on adventures in the live-action world. The brothers set up Out of the Inkwell Films, which later became Fleischer Studios. While out on the West Coast, Disney worked his butt off to sell his Alice comedies to a distributor. Despite the hustle he was putting in, he ended up striking out quite often. In a fortuitous meeting, Walt Disney was able to hook up with New York animated film distributor Margaret J. Winkler. At the time, Winkler was losing out on the rights to some of the biggest names in her portfolio. Those would include the Fleischers and their Out of the Inkwell tunes and Sullivan's aforementioned Felix the Cat. She was in need of some new blood and fast. Bossert adds, by the fall of 1923, Disney had been communicating with Winkler for months. At this point, she was having ongoing issues with both the Fleischers and Sullivan. The Fleischer brothers were considering signing with another distributor, while Winkler was having ongoing disputes with Pat Sullivan, who, according to a number of sources, was a difficult personality. Winkler was getting equally frustrated with Disney and was anxious for an opportunity to screen a print of Alice's Wonderland. In October of 1923, Walt and Winkler signed a deal to produce six Alice comedies, with a further option for two more sets of six episodes each. Disney and his brother Roy used this opportunity to form the Disney Brothers Studio to produce these films. The Disneys weren't the only ones to relocate for this venture. They even persuaded their Alice, Virginia Davis, and her family to relocate to Hollywood to continue production. This change of scenery scored Davis a $100 a month contract. The final pieces of the puzzle fell into place in July of 1924 when Walt persuaded UB iWorks to relocate to Hollywood from Kansas City. By now, having had a few years pass, UB was now the head of the art department for the film ad company. Ub had been busy working to develop his own artistic style while also studying the current techniques of animation. He was definitely working hard to improve his craft. This was the perfect time to head out, and the invite from Walt really excited him, really gave him a goal, gave him something to shoot for. The Historic Missourian's website article adds, "With $500 borrowed from his uncle and help from his brother Roy, Disney started Disney Brothers Studio. He acquired a New York distributor to release his Alice comedies. Roy became the studio manager, and Ub Iwerks and Ham Hamilton joined the team as animators. The Alice comedies became very popular, and soon Disney's staff grew, and he built a new studio on Hyperion Avenue." The return of Ub Iwerks to the film fold would have an immediate impact on the cartoon business of Disney. Once Ub, an artist of legendary speed and skill, arrived on staff in July of 1924, there was a noticeable uptick in quality in the Alice comedies, with more and stronger animation and less live action, but with technical improvements on how the two were combined, David Bossert writes. It's at this point that we really see the payoff for Ub from all the work he had done honing his craft. His personal style of animation really set the Disney Brothers studio apart on a technical level. Abandoning the stiff and rudimentary methods of animation he had learned, Ub began his own straight-ahead style of drawing, which did not rely on model sheets or beginning and end marks. Structure was thrown out to make way for his own free-flowing push to the next emotion, the documentary explains. In an article for the April 28, 1985 edition of the New York Times, written by Carol A. Hayes, we get a glimpse of that working relationship between Margaret Winkler and Walt Disney. Hayes interviewed Winkler, who had this to say. She said, "Walt Disney was very likable," Miss Mintz recalled, adding that his humor came through in his cartoons rather than his conversation. Soon, Alice's Wild West show and Alice's Day at Sea, starring Virginia Davis and her police dog Peggy, were being distributed. Mr. Disney, who was juxtaposing human and cartoon action, produced the Alice cartoons in Hollywood, where George Winkler, one of Miss Mintz's brothers, had set up a branch office. Turning to the Laback Comiclopedia website again, we learn about the division of work between Walt and Ub. The article reads, "By 1926, Disney quit working as an artist to focus exclusively on production and story development. Iwerks became his main animator. By dividing the tasks, each man could do what he was best at. Iwerks was such a fine draftsman and fast worker that he did most of the work in the cartoons single-handedly. They had a great run with their Alice pictures for nearly 4 years. Eventually, though, interest at large started to dwindle in the Alice comedies, and by 1927, Walt knew it was coming to a close and really felt it. The use of a live-action character was becoming less and less integral to the stories told on screen, and the lead animated character, Julius the Cat, was becoming a little too derivative of the ultra-popular Felix the Cat. Walt tried his damnedest to differentiate Julius, but Winkler and her husband Charles Mintz pushed back on that front. On top of the creative rut the team found themselves in, a mental and physical strain was creeping in. They were pumping out a new short every 2-ish weeks, and it was starting to take its toll for sure." Now, let's focus a little bit on that Charles Mintz fellow real quick. You're probably wondering why Margaret Winkler's husband had so much pull, right? By 1926, Winkler's role in the distribution of the Alice comedies had been handed over to her husband, film producer Charles Mintz. This switchover was not always smooth, and the relationship between him and Disney was sometimes strained. Rocky, even. The Alice series ran until July 1927. Like I mentioned earlier, the Alice comedies were an interesting mix of live-action girl in a toon town. Walt Disney was starting to tire of the mixed media situation and wanted to move all to an all-animated entertainment front. Mintz came to Walt and requested a new project to distribute with Universal Pictures. This was the impetus for Disney and Iwerks creating Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, a character Disney wanted to be peppy, alert, saucy, and venturesome, keeping him also neat and trim. With the creation of Oswald underway, Winkler would sign a contract with Universal on March 4, 1927. This deal guaranteed 26 Oswald the Lucky Rabbit cartoons. Now that money had changed hands and contracts were signed, work on both the character and the series began in earnest. Not long after that, Disney moved to his studio on Hyperion Avenue in Los Angeles. In one of the few ideas that all parties agreed on, the decision was made to design a non-cat character. Cartoons of the time were full of famous felines like Felix and Crazy Cat, just to name a few. The idea of a rabbit was eventually settled upon. The species of the main character wasn't the only thing Walt wanted to upgrade in his cartoons. He also wanted to level up the ambitions of the once simple animated short. According to John Kanemaker in his article Life Before Mickey, from the July 10, 1994 edition of the New York Times, we learn about those lofty ambitions. Kanemaker writes, "To make his Oswald cartoons look real, Disney turned away from the magical world of Felix the Cat, Coco the Clown, and Crazy Cat and started emulating the camera angles, effects, and editing of live-action films. He studied Laurel and Hardy, Harold Lloyd, Charlie Chaplin, and especially Buster Keaton to learn how to base gags on personality and how to build comic routines, rather than piling one gag on top of another. And by scrutinizing the shadow effects, cross-cutting, and staging of action in films starring Douglas Fairbanks and Lon Chaney, Disney learned how to stir emotion in an audience." One of the things that is so unusual about Oswald at that time is that he, too, is full of detachable body parts. But now there are some somatic consequences. When you tweak his nose, when you pull his ears, he hurts. He can cry, he can laugh, he can become a manic depressive. You're getting away from the slapstick gag into personality gags. And as you do that, some of Ub's quirkier personality traits start coming to the surface. The sense of anarchy starts to rule in Oswald as it never had in the Alice cartoons. Russell Merritt says, "Despite a lot of high ideals and incredible sources of inspiration, the first outing proved to be nearly disastrous." Bossert explains, "Walt sent over the drawings and sketches of Oswald, but the enthusiasm was short-lived. For when Walt sent over the first Oswald cartoon, Poor Papa, a little over 2 weeks later, it received a disappointing response from both Universal and Mintz. What exactly is it about Poor Papa that caused so many issues and forced its release to be pushed back until well after other Oswald cartoons? Let's dive in, shall we?" So after that prelude and prologue, that leads us to our first of two shorts we'll be discussing here on this episode. And that is the first ever one, though not the first aired, Poor Papa. David Bossert explains that the reaction to Poor Papa wasn't as bad as some sources claim. Bossert writes, "It's a widely circulated urban legend that Universal rejected Poor Papa outright. As early as 1927, however, the film seems to have been sent out for at least one advance review, and in 1928, as Oswald grew in popularity, it was belatedly slipped into the general release schedule. And despite the bad optics from the studio brass, it still was received rather well by reviewers." David Bossert recounts the opening of this short. He writes, "The cartoon itself opens up on the interior of Oswald's home, where the audience sees Oswald smoking a corncob pipe as he paces about with a child at his side. Oswald turns and looks at the closed door on the back wall, tapping his chin and obviously waiting for something. Outside, above the house, storks fly in with sacks of baby rabbits, depositing them down the chimney. That night, on a Saturday night, Oswald washes the children in a barrel and comes up with an ingenious way of tying them up and running them through a ringer before hanging them up to dry. While a bunch of kids are playing outside, a number of them are inside being incredibly destructive. Some are jumping on the piano, sawing legs off a table, others drilling holes in the furniture. Oswald has become inundated with children, I guess as rabbits are often wont to do. There is no peace for Oswald. Next, we catch up with him trying to churn butter, as you did back in the day. He can't churn in peace because he is constantly annoyed by the children's antics. He grabs one and spanks him, but the child runs away and thumbs his nose at Oswald. Another child drops a bar of soap, upon which Oswald slips and falls. Fed up, the father grabs a rifle and climbs to the roof. The staging at first suggests Oswald might be planning to shoot the children, Bossert explains, but he has other plans in mind. With his shotgun in hand, Oswald goes onto the roof of the house. He looks through a spyglass and spots his real target, an army of storks heading toward his home carrying even more babies. He puts up a no vacancy sign above the house and decides he will accept no more children and starts firing away at the baby-carrying birds. He shoots at them and it drives them away, but one drops its sack of babies that ends up falling down the chimney. The storks drew first blood, not Oswald. Now Oswald is going to give them a war they won't believe. In an effort to stop them from getting in the chimney, he does what any sensible father would do and ties the chimney up in a knot, which makes for a great visual metaphor. He laughs watching the storks struggle with the chimney. When the storks are unable to use the chimney, though, they make other plans. Not seeing them drop the babies into the house's open water tank, Oswald turns on the tap to fill a pot and is taken aback when numerous babies pour out of the spigot. A defeated and deflated Oswald staggers back against the wall and slides down with his mouth open and a hand on his head. The cartoon ends with an iris out to a close. The end. Now, you may be thinking, what is wrong with that? Seems like a perfectly serviceable short, right? Well, according to David Bossert, Universal and Mintz felt that there were too many ancillary characters, specifically a swarm of babies and storks, causing Oswald to get lost in the action. They also thought Oswald was too elderly and quote-unquote sloppy and fat, and they wanted him to be quote-unquote young and snappy looking. Mintz even suggested that the character have a monocle, which Walt later declined. Now, it's not just about what programs or films a person watches that are influences and gateways to entering the furry fandom. It also comes down to specific characters in each film, book, or story that also plays a huge part. Now, I asked Nuka about the role of specific characters, and he came back with a tremendous answer that really made me think. He told me, some of the biggest influences we've encountered when talking to furries include characters from the shows and series mentioned earlier, like Robin Hood or Sonic. That said, it differs extensively depending on who you're talking to and their age. I've definitely noticed generational differences in what characters and series furries identify with. I've joked that you can approximate a furry's age by whether it was Robin Hood, The Lion King, or Zootopia that got them into the fandom. It's also fascinating to see how strongly individual characters can have an impact on a person's persona. To be sure, Nuka continues, inspiration from a particular media character is only one of countless reasons why someone may choose the persona that they do, and it could be argued that the character might not be the cause of the interest, but rather a manifestation of an underlying interest to begin with. So for all those furs out there who fell into the fandom as a result of Oswald the Lucky Rabbit shorts from the 20s, bless you and your incredibly long life and devotion to Oswald. Another shout out goes to the more recent furs who have also found inspiration from the nearly 100-year-old rabbit, if there are any out there. And if you did be inspired by Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, write into the show, let us know. That would be awesome to hear. Now, the second cinematic stab at Oswald came with Trolley Troubles. This second attempt at Oswald had its West and East Coast premieres on July 4th and 9th, 1927 respectively, at Los Angeles' Criterion Theater and New York's Roxy. The film went into general circulation on September 5th, its official Universal release date, writes David Bossert. We start out with Oswald at the trolley station preparing his trolley for a busy day of transportation, as his numerous children, whom you may recognize from Poor Papa, play around him. He dusts the trolley off and uses his tail as a loofah sponge and eventually oils it up and gets it ready to go. He makes his way around picking up riders of all sorts on some really wild tracks. There is some really amazing animation in this sequence as the track narrows and widens over hills, downhills, that really gives the viewer a great sense of motion. His perfect ride comes to a halt, though, when a troublesome cow blocks the track. Oswald is none too pleased and tries his hardest to get her to move. She is having none of it. He backs the trolley up and speeds forward in an attempt to plow through her. It does not work. Seeing as he can't get through her, he backs the trolley up before squeezing it down super small to get under her. Later in the ride, Oswald is taking the trolley up a steep hill. Incredibly steep. Vertical, actually. He needs to figure out how to get up, though. Luckily, he gets rammed by a ram. He tricks the ram into pushing them up and over the hill. But when you go up a hill like that, that means you're going to come down pretty darn fast. And now the trolley is speeding down the hill at an alarming speed. It is out of control as it traverses the hilly countryside. David Bossert writes, "The trolley is zooming along, flinging passengers off as it twists and turns up and down small hills, eventually leaving conductor Oswald all by his lonesome self and plowing through and out of tunnels. Nearing the end of this short, we find one of its funniest gags, in which Oswald pulls off one of his feet before kissing it and rubbing the lucky rabbit's foot on his head before reattaching it. Then, for good measure, he prays. This rabbit's foot gag occurs in other Oswald shorts and gets a laugh every time. He eventually drives off a cliff into a river, where he turns the trolley into a raft and uses a trolley pole to paddle away." The end. In an issue of Motion Picture News, Charles J. Smith would write, "If the first of these new cartoon comedies for Universal is an indication of what is to come, then this series is destined to win much popular favor. They are cleverly drawn, well executed, brimful of action, and fairly abounding in humorous situations." Disney was an expert storyteller and instinctively knew the shorts would be more successful if Oswald was more than a bystander. Instead, the humor arose from situations created for Oswald's world and his reactions to them. The quality of the animation was also superior to the work of other studios, mostly because of iWork's technical expertise and his skill at drawing perspective, Scott Brogan writes. Ub's growing fascination with the technical side of the art would also make its way into the characters he created. Introducing the machine gag, animals' limbs became technical contraptions to solve any range of problems, the Ub iWorks documentary tells us. Now, I really loved these Oswald shorts. He really is a different character than most animation I have ever seen. He really has a cool edginess to him that you don't really see very often. His emotion and attitude practically jump off the screen. I can't say enough great stuff about the technical expertise of the animation either. You can really see Ub iWorks in everything he puts on screen. The stuff he was able to achieve was jaw-dropping and totally stands up to anything put out today. Scott Brogan, in an essay for silentfilm.org, explains the creative and business groove that Walt and Ub were in during the height of the Oswald shorts. He writes, "Disney and iWorks developed an assembly line system that met Disney's desire for top quality animation, story, and character development, as well as allowing for them to churn out one film every 2 weeks, as mandated by their contract with Mintz and Universal. Through Oswald, Disney was also realized the potential for character merchandising. From the outset, Universal had promoted Oswald tie-in products, the first being an Oswald the Lucky Rabbit chocolate bar that hit the shelves in 1927. Now that's a mark of a popular product and a great idea. I mean, nowadays, movie tie-ins and widespread marketing are really nothing new, but back in the 20s, this is relatively uncharted territory. The thing that's crazy, though, is that all of this success would start the ball rolling that led to distrust, mistrust, and a series of double crosses. But for now, things were going pretty great, actually. Almost immediately, critics and audiences warmed to Oswald. They loved his offbeat design with his long, expressive ears and how fitfully and artfully executed the shorts were. Incredibly, there were 9 Oswald shorts released in 1927 alone. The success of the Oswald shorts was enough so that Walt and his brother and business partner Roy could hire more animators. Their company swelled to 22 people, and they were able to buy plots of land on Lyric Avenue in Silver Lake. But while the success was great for Walt, Roy and Ub behind the scenes, chaos was brewing, writes Drew Taylor on Collider.com in an article entitled The Incredible True Story of Disney's Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. Despite the clear successes of the Oswald series, there was treachery afoot in the back rooms and offices frequented by Charles Mintz, a little Succession-esque for the animation set, if you will. At this point, as Walt and company were producing the initial run of 26 shorts, his relationship with Mintz only grew worse. David Bossert explains, Mintz continued to have little faith in Walt, regularly scolding him for giving credit to his brother-in-law, George Winkler, for the success of the Oswald productions. Mintz felt Walt brought little to the shorts, especially since Walt no longer handled any of the animation himself. Reflecting on Walt's incessant quibbling over money and control, Mintz decided he could do without him. That state of mind by Mintz would lay the groundwork for a good old-fashioned betrayal. Mint saw greener and more lucrative pastures from Universal on the horizon. The only thing he needed was to cut Walt out of the business. Oh, and maybe poach some of the talented artists from his core of animators. Bossert writes, expecting a new contract from Universal for more Oswald films, Mintz laid the groundwork for separation from Walt, all legal, but underhanded nonetheless. Plans were drawn up to produce the 1928-1929 season of Oswald shorts from a new animation house run by George Winkler directly. Mintz had already directed his brother-in-law to recruit Harmon and other Disney animators in what amounted to a coup d'etat of sorts. By taking over the character and the contract, if not the studio, and cutting Walt out altogether. Walt had no clue any of this treachery was even going on behind the scenes. In fact, it was friend Ub Iwerks who alerted Disney to the situation by telling him that Mintz was collecting his cartoonists. The way this all went down was just too unbelievable for Walt. I mean, it wasn't until Ub explained that Mintz had approached him to leave too that Walt finally started to take it seriously. Walt tried an end-around by attempting to renegotiate a new contract with Mintz and avoid all the current unpleasantness. In an effort to strengthen his position in potential negotiations, Walt tried to get a competing offer only to come up empty. With Disney's leverage gone, Mintz came back to Walt with a contract that had terms that were even harsher than their previous deal. Mintz also broke the news to Walt that he was a subcontractor to Winkler Productions and was disposable. And that wasn't the worst of it in Walt's eyes. With most of his crew signed away and his place in the company in question, the worst revelation was yet to come. Bossert writes, the fine print of the Oswald paperwork gave Walt no ownership rights to Oswald. If Mintz had a Universal contract, control over the character lay with Mintz. Walt had nothing. It was a devastating blow to him, and he was left with no remedy or alternative. Winkler Productions owned the rights to Disney and Iwerks' creation. Walt learned one thing from this whole ordeal. He promised himself he would never work for anyone again. Going forward, he was going to be his own boss and have control over his company's creations and fortunes. Now, he just had to finish his contractually obligated Oswald work. But as you'll soon learn, Lucky Rabbit cartoons weren't the only thing the gang had up their sleeves. Turning back to David Bossert, we learn, while finishing off the Oswald obligations, Walt, Roy, and Ub were working on a new character named Mickey Mouse in secret, behind locked doors at the Hyperion Studio and at Walt and Roy's homes on Lyric Avenue. The creation of Mickey was an incredibly clandestine operation, with fake work and drawings strewn about in case anyone got nosy. In spring of 1928, Disney was removed from the Oswald series completely, and much of his staff was hired away to Winkler Pictures. He promised to never again work with a character he did not own. With Walt and crew out of the picture, Charles Mintz and his Winkler Pictures Corporation were free to proceed with that next batch of 26 Oswald cartoons. During that time, Walter Lantz was hired on. Now, Lantz was a former animator and director at Bray Studios, who brought a fair amount of experience to his new position and workplace. This hiring would prove incredibly interesting and demonstrate to Charles Mintz that what goes around often comes around. David Bossert adds, Winkler may have had a 3-year contract to provide Oswald cartoons to Universal, but after some quiet negotiations between Lantz and Carl Laemmle, Universal's founder and CEO, Winkler's contract was terminated 1 year in. This is a great example of what is good for the goose is good for the gander, I guess. Now, Disney had no Oswald, Winkler had no Oswald, and they were all left out in the cold with Universal to pick up the action, the Oswald action, if you will. Starting with the 1929-1930 season, Bossert continues, the Oswald series was produced by Lantz and animator Bill Nolan at a new studio in the Universal lot. It was Oswald's third studio in as many years. While being drawn up at Universal, Oswald would have some prolific big-screen adventures. More than 140 Oswald shorts were made under the leadership of Lantz and Nolan. And an interesting side note about this era of Oswald was that famed animator Tex Avery would be heavily involved in this run. Back on the Disney side of the ledger, new ideas were percolating. If a new character was to be created, Walt and Ub would do it themselves, for themselves. Disney asked Iwerks, who remained loyal and stayed with him, to start drawing up new character ideas. Iwerks tried sketches of frogs, dogs, cats, but none of those really appealed to Disney. A female cow and male horse were created at this time by Iwerks, but they were also rejected. According to David Bossert, Iwerks drew the first sketches of Mickey Mouse based, to some degree, on the Oswald character design. If one places the 1928 version of Oswald next to the 1928 version of Mickey Mouse, one will notice many of the similarities, the most obvious being that both characters are based on a circle or spherical design. The first handful of Mickey Mouse cartoons were animated almost entirely by Iwerks. Harnessing everything he learned from Kansas City to Oswald, his creative output would prove unstoppable. Designing and defining circle after circle, line after line, the entire body was a fluid composition. Each curve, each twist was there to serve a dynamic purpose. What would normally take months to accomplish, Ub did in just 2 weeks. Ub Iwerks would single-handedly animate the first Mickey Mouse cartoon, Plain Crazy, the documentary tells us. This first outing would be greatly inspired by Charles Lindbergh, whose legendary aviation exploits were national news at the time. The contributions of Iwerks, as time passed, would seem to disappear or simply move to the background where they weren't as easily visible. I can totally admit I was one of the unknowledgeable people that felt this, that noticed this. I've been a huge fan of Disney my whole life and had never heard the name of Iwerks until diving into this episode. I'm so glad I did dig a bit further to see this incredible legacy. Leonard Maltin sums it up thusly. He says, Ub Iwerks had a lot to do, some might say everything to do, with creating the physical look of Mickey Mouse and his movement. It's a style that ended up being copied for several years by almost everybody in the business. This new era of mouse animation would continue the workloads that both men had been used to and perfected over the years. Walt would handle writing the stories and gags, while Ub drew the layouts, concept designs, and animation. The Galloping Gaucho would be the second Mickey Mouse cartoon. At this time, however, times in the cinema were a-changin'. Walt wanted to push the envelope, and as he saw it, the best way to do that was to include sound in their next Mickey cartoon. It's the summer of 1928, and sound in movies was picking up steam. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And on November 18, 1928, Walt sat in on the first public screening in New York of what would be the world's first synchronized sound cartoon, Steamboat Willie. Leonard Maltin explains what a game-changer Steamboat Willie was. Maltin says, "When Walt unveiled Steamboat Willie and it became the sensation that it was, cartoons took a quantum leap forward. Because now cartoons offered a novelty, and a tremendous novelty that no one else could seem to top. And it changed everything, it turned everything around." The wild success that was Steamboat Willie allowed Walt to sign a deal for more Mickey cartoons, with Ub set to animate, and Mickey would soon take his place as one of the biggest movie stars in the world, to the point of Mickey Mouse shorts getting top billing over feature films at movie theaters around the world. The Skeleton Dance would be the first silly symphony to be released. This confluence of music and animation would prove to be a huge hit as well. These cartoons were really quite experimental, blending popular music, vaudeville, and dance that helped make them a success with crowds of every age and race. Now, despite all the successes at Walt Disney Studios, things were slowly breaking down between Walt and Ub. It had been 10 years since the two first met in Kansas City, and the Disney studio was growing. With the demand for Disney cartoons growing, more employees were brought on, and more money was being invested. Things were growing exponentially behind the scenes, and that led to some friction between the two. As things grew, Walt started to take the reins of artistic control within Disney in ways Ub didn't expect. Merritt tells us, "Part of it was professional, part of it was personal, and part of it was economic. Ub was much freer as an independent spirit who would then show Disney his work only after it was completed. Now, with the expansion of the Disney studio, and with the increasing formalization of responsibilities, that kind of independence was something that Disney felt he couldn't afford." Film historian Mark Kausler shares a more detailed look. He explains, "Walt would be constantly rewriting Ub's exposure sheets to change the timing to something he wanted. And it was different than what Ub imagined when he was animating it. Timing is very sacred to an animator because it's such an integral part. It's not just drawings. It's drawings as applied to film time. The rate of exposure is important to get the effects across that an animator wants. and the fact that somebody was changing it, Walt was fooling around and changing it, probably disturbed him fundamentally. Eventually, Iwerks and Disney had a falling out. Their friendship and working partnership were severed in January of 1930. Iwerks accepted a contract with Disney's former distributor, Pat Powers, who offered Ub his own studio and a chance to make his name just as famous as Walt's. He gave Ub the one thing he valued, control to make the cartoons he wanted. Dave Smith, Walt Disney archivist, says, "Walt Disney was devastated when Ub Iwerks left the company because Ub was such an accomplished animator. He was really the father of the animators at the Disney studio. They all looked up to him. They all went to him when they had questions. And losing that key person at the Disney studio caused Walt to have a lot of worries about what was going to happen in the future. While the two did have their personal differences, their mutual respect for each other would continue." And that, I guess, is a good place to leave this tale of Oswald the Lucky Rabbit for now. There are still an incredibly large number of fascinating stories about the long and lost life of that famous rabbit. We here at the Golden Silent Films podcast have some more animated adventures ahead for you to marvel at, and we want to save some of those stories for another time. In an article for silentfilm.org written by Scott Brogan, we get a great wrap-up of our story so far. The essay is entitled Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, 1927 to 1928, and tells us, "As for Oswald, he had a life after Disney. Eclipsed by Mickey's fame, he faded from films in 1938, appearing one last time in 1943. He lasted longer in print, gracing the comic pages through the 1960s in the U.S., and later in Mexico and Italy. In 2004 and 2005, the original Oswald became a pop culture hit in Japan, spawning a craze. Finally, in 2006, the Walt Disney Company reacquired Oswald as part of an assets exchange with Universal. After almost 70 years, Oswald was finally home at Disney, taking his place alongside Mickey and the rest of the iconic Disney characters." So, as we lay this episode to rest, it is time to find out where your favorite silent stars are laid to rest. This is the segment where we join our favorite cinematic stars on the other side of the cemetery gates. The history, the art, the celebrity spectacle converge in Where Are They Now? Your guide to paying your respects to the amazing animators that have entertained us so dang much. Now, despite the early tightness between Ub and Walt throughout the 20s, Ub would eventually seek his own path. This meant his time at Disney Studios came to an end in January of 1930. Iwerks' last work on a Mickey Mouse cartoon came in 1930's The Cactus Kid. Now on his own, Ub started his own production company, Iwerks Studio. The documentary tells us, opening an office in Hollywood, Ub launched his new character, Flip the Frog. With distribution guaranteed by MGM and a staff of soon-to-be who's who of animation pioneers, the Ub Iwerks Studio was expected to be one of the top in the industry. Leonard Maltin adds, "People who worked with Ub back then still speak with a certain degree of awe about his technical facility. His ability to draw perfect circles, to do something in perfect perspective, to make anything move, not just a character, but an inanimate object." The talent at the studio led to big profits early on with Flip the Frog and later Willy Whopper. With the introduction of his new Comic Color series, this would become Ub's catalyst for his own technical ventures. With $300 and using parts from the back end of a 1920s Chevrolet, Ub set to work on his own version of the first three-dimensional camera. With this technology, Ub was able to make cartoons that existed on several planes. Now, don't worry, the podcast is not going existential or multidimensional. It's just a way of saying Ub did something amazing to really give the viewer a depth of field not seen in animation before then. Like many segments of the entertainment industry, the animation sector also fell victim to the Hays Code. While the cartoons of Walt Disney were very well liked and drew in a number of demographics, the Comic Color shorts could be very weird and inspired by real-world events like the Great Depression. The sharp satire that became identified with the Iwerks studio was well received in the early 30s, but by the mid-30s, as production codes were coming into effect, people wanted reassurance and a celebration of the New Deal. Ub's stark representation of humanity, even in cartoons, was getting harder to accept. Despite the talent, experience, and contracts, the Ub Iwerks studio was not long for this world. With the dissolution of the MGM contract in 1934, Iwerks took his work to the independent route. This led to smaller audiences and declining profits. Unfortunately, financial backers of the studio withdrew their support of the operation in 1936, and it shuttered down in 1938. Now, Iwerks would go on to direct two Looney Tunes cartoon shorts for Leon Schlesinger Productions, and several Color Rhapsody cartoons for Screen Gems. Despite not excelling with his own studio, Ub Iwerks was an incredibly talented artist who not only contributed, but innovated in the motion picture space. Scott Brogan writes, "In the 1930s, Iwerks started his own studio producing shorts for Columbia Pictures and Warner Brothers Looney Tunes series. Iwerks returned to Disney in 1940. Iwerks later concentrated mostly on visual effects, developing improved processes for combining live action with animation, first used in The Three Caballeros in 1944, and the Zero Graphic process pioneered in 101 Dalmatians in 1961. He won two Academy Awards for his technical work and received a nomination for the bird effects in Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds in 1963. He also helped develop many of Disneyland's animatronic attractions." Now, rewinding a little bit to the topic of awards and awards that Ub earned, Ub and his crew won a special Oscar for the development of the sodium matte traveling process for his work in 1965's Mary Poppins. You can think of this concept as an early green screen, the ability to film on a blank background and add the background later. So for the conception and perfection of techniques for color traveling matte composite cinematography, the Academy presented the Class 1 Scientific or Technical Award to Petro Vlahos, Wadsworth E. Pohl, and Ub Iwerks. As a quick side note, as someone who is fascinated, incredibly fascinated by names, I think that threesome is about as top-notch, super best as it gets. On December 15, 1966, Ub's life would change. On that day, Walt Disney died at the age of 65. Walt was a constant in Ub's life through the ups and the downs. The two men collaborated and created unimaginable things together. Despite their roads in life merging and splitting and merging again, they had truly changed the world of film. Don Iwerks, Ub's son, recounts the day the terrible news reached Ub. Don says, "That was a day I'll remember forever, because they happened to be down on the shop floor. It had come over the radio, and our secretary went over the PA system and announced through the shop that Walt had passed away. That was kind of a tough way to learn of it, being as close to Walt as he was all those years, to hear of it that way. But he and I sat in my office a little later. They dismissed everybody. The whole place went home right away. We were there for a little while. He came up to my office and sat down. He was obviously upset that it happened, and his words were, 'That's the end of an era.' Not only did he lose a friend, but he lost that person to whom he was dedicated to please." Iwerks had two children, Donald and David Iwerks, both born with his partner Mildred Sarah Henderson. Their love affair came as a result of a blind date in 1926 and a marriage in 1927. He is also the grandfather of documentary film producer and director Leslie Iwerks. Ub died of a heart attack in Burbank, California in 1971 at the age of 70. His ashes are interred in a niche in the Columbarium of Remembrance at Forest Lawn Memorial Park in Hollywood Hills Cemetery, map number 2E3 back wall, outdoor garden niche 61147, with Mildred nearby, of course. Ub Iwerks was named a Disney legend posthumously in 1989. In addition to those three Academy Award nominations, he also posthumously received the Winsor McCay Award for his contributions to animation at the 1978 Annie Awards and the Hall of Fame Award at the 2017 Visual Effects Society Awards. Don Iwerks recounts his father's legacy. Don would say, "In all of his work, my dad was one to put yesterday behind him. And he was never focused on yesterday or his accomplishments or any of that. It made no difference to him. He once said of Mickey, and he said it on numerous occasions, he said, 'It isn't creating it, it's what you do with it.'" That was an incredible tale on many different fronts, and a lot of information to be processed for sure. But before everything gets totally tied up in a nice episode-ending bow, let's spend a little more time with our amazing guest, Dr. Courtney Plant, a.k.a. Nuka. He has already given us so much great stuff to think about, I didn't want him to leave without a few more furry notes and insights. As a co-founder of Fur Science, Nuka has seen, heard, and archived so much furry-centric information, I had to know what were some of the findings he holds near and dear to his scientific heart. Nuka told me, "Historically, one of my favorite findings has been to show just how prominent the LGBTQ plus population is amongst furries. Most furries, in fact, are LGBTQ plus. It's not all that unremarkable to furries, but it's one of those things that was generally suspected to be the case, but being able to put numbers to it was pretty satisfying. But it's not all heavy-duty information regarding life and love and fur being calculated by fur science. There are also some weird anomalies, some fascinating numbers out there too, which Nuka also finds fascinating. He lets us in on an avenue that piqued his interest for further research. He explains, "I also think the finding that furries are twice as likely to be the oldest sibling rather than the youngest sibling is fun. I have no idea why this is the case, but it's one of those examples of a delicious mystery that's just begging to be investigated." One thing that needs no investigation, however, is the city of Pittsburgh's relationship to furries and Anthrocon. Needless to say, it is a great relationship, personally and financially. Nuka, as a furry and fur science-er, gets around to a lot of conventions, but Anthrocon holds a special place in his heart. He explains, "I think Anthrocon is, and has been for many years, one of the best-known furry conventions. One of the biggest, and was the biggest for many years, and certainly the one which has gotten the most positive press coverage. For me, going there for the first time felt sort of like making a pilgrimage to Mecca, like a thing that all furries should do at some point in their lives. It's also fantastic because the con is so much bigger than the con space. The whole city really gets into it, and so for blocks around, the restaurants and stores all cater to furries, so you never break that immersive feel of the con, even when you're darting out to get food. So its size and renown was definitely a draw from the beginning." According to a 2018 issue of the Pittsburgh Business Times, Anthrocon was responsible for $7.9 million in spending in Allegheny County, home of Pittsburgh. Those numbers are wild. In fact, it's the third most valuable convention to the city of Pittsburgh. In addition to the retail dollars spent in Pittsburgh, the attendees of Anthrocon also give back to various animal-based charities in big, big ways. Just in 2022 alone, over $42,000 was raised for a wildlife charity, and that's not an anomaly. Every year, attendees have donated over $35,000 or more that I was able to look at a list of past conventions. It really is great to see that while ostensibly you're there for fun and partying and having a good time, there also really is a societal component. There's something that the furries do to give back as well. Now, I was not joking when I said Pittsburgh loves furries. I have been to Anthrocon 4 times now. Every time, I would venture further and further into the experience. I had always known about Anthrocon from the numerous positive and sometimes negative television news stories and newspaper articles, but never really investigated it too deeply. My first personal interaction with the fandom was a late night out on a party bus dropping me and my friends outside the David L. Lawrence Convention Center. It was an incredible night of hanging out with furries and realizing I had a lot to learn about partying. That experience led me to having got full weekend registrations over the last couple years and diving in head first. The fun and positive atmosphere fostered by Anthrocon has been amazing to experience firsthand. It is quite the major event every year, and the city is always there to roll out the red carpet and welcome the furry fandom in. The only disappointing thing for me is that I waited so long to fully experience the wild weekend that is Anthrocon. Anthrocon has done an incredible job cultivating a symbiotic relationship with the city of Pittsburgh, Nuka tells me. At most other cons, as soon as you leave the hotel or convention center, you're just in a regular old city. You feel like a weirdo furry walking around getting strange looks from people while you try to go to lunch or go to a convenience store for something. But Anthrocon, you almost feel like a celebrity. For blocks outside the con, you can walk around as a furry and people will stop you for pictures and treat you like a tourist attraction. You feel famous and almost excited to be seen as a furry out in public. I haven't been to many other places where you get that feeling. Anthrocon really is a worldwide event. Furries travel from every corner of the globe to attend Anthrocon. This is one of the great side effects of such a widely attended con. It's these conventions that really help build the furry fandom, and they have a lot of great benefits to furries and non-furries alike. That's a concept not lost on Nuka. In fact, he has seen the impact of convention attendance firsthand. He explains, furries primarily interact with one another online, partly out of historical precedence, i.e. the modern fandom has its origins largely in online spaces like Mux, forums, and message boards, and partly out of necessity, as furries are often separated by hundreds or even thousands of miles geographically. Conventions represent a chance to see other furries in meat space, as they'd say in cyberpunk stories. It can be really validating to meet up with other furries in person. It helps make this strange hobby you have feel more valid when you can see and hear and hug the people you've been interacting with online for so long. As the closing credits roll on this episode and our convention space empties out, we want to thank you again, as always, for joining us on this anthropomorphic adventure through animated history. Did you enjoy this rascally yet lucky rabbit? What are some of your favorite cartoons of the silent era? Do tell us your favorite anthropomorphic characters, and tell us, have you ever been to a furry convention? Let us know all that and more at the various social media hangouts of the Golden Silent Films podcast. And this episode wouldn't be complete without a heartfelt thanks to Dr. Courtney Plant, a.k.a. Nuka, and everyone at First Science. He was so gracious with his time and so helpful in answering every question thrown his way. He brought such great insights to this episode, and I really feel like it gave a new perspective to the proceedings. All this while working hard to publish a new First Science book. He was a real trooper, and this episode really benefited from his time and knowledge. This episode will be released just before opening ceremonies of the 2023 edition of AnthroCon on June 29th, 2023. And if you are at AnthroCon, do keep an eye open for your faithful silent film podcaster here. We will be around checking things out. It's going to be a great weekend in the Berg. It always is. And if you've never been, maybe you don't hear it in time, but definitely check this event out in the future. If you want to learn more about the furry fandom, go no further than supporting Fur Science and their amazing work. You can learn more by heading to furscience.com, finding them on Facebook, and be sure to follow them on Twitter at Fur Science. That's at F-U-R-S-C-I-E-N-C-E. And if you want to check out that book Nuka is working on right now at this very moment, you can pick it up in August and learn all kinds of cool stuff about the furry fandom. And if you didn't catch any of that or you missed a little bit, I will be putting all those links in the episode description. So please feel free to click on the episode description and we will get you to Fur Science for sure. On that note, if you have forgotten, we are on Instagram and Twitter. Let us know what you think of this episode. What silent-related movies, past or present, do you want us to dip into next? Our world of silent movie knowledge and experience is always growing, and we need your input to plot out our future episodes here in Season 3 and beyond. You can always find us at Golden Silence Cast on Instagram and at Golden Silence 1 on Twitter. And again, if you listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast outlet that allows it, subscribe, rate, review. It totally helps us a lot here, and we always love hearing your thoughts and ideas. We really, really appreciate all of your incredible support, and seeing how much you folks are listening only makes us want to make bigger, better, and hopefully more episodes. And with all that being said, thank you to all of you fine furries for all of your fine furry listening. And don't forget, the silents are golden and the talkies, they're just a fad. Walt Disney once said, Oswald will not only be able to hold his own with the competition, but will set a pace that will make others hustle. Old Walt sure wasn't kidding on that.